If you're new with us this morning, we're really glad you're here. If you're not new, then you know where we've been. We're in the book, the Gospel of Matthew, and we're in a particular section of chapters 23, 24, and 25. And this particular section of Matthew is a very unique one. It's the fifth teaching section of the book. All right, so there's these unique teaching sections that have gone from explaining kingdom values to then entering into what kingdom mission is all about and what that looks like, right on to the parables that we call kingdom secrets that Jesus taught, and Matthew gathered those together into a particular chapter 13. And then he went on to chapter 18 and began to talk about kingdom living. What does that look like? How do we handle relationships? And how do we live in this thing called the kingdom and even the church today? And now, in chapters 23, 24, and 25, we call it kingdom warnings, because as Jesus enters into the last week of his life, he begins to say some really profoundly important things. And some of them are very difficult to look at. So they call them kingdom warnings. Now, around these chapters are narratives, or Matthew is telling the story of the events of Jesus' life. And he organizes this gospel in such a way that we are designed to know what it means to be a follower of him and how to live and obey all the commandments that he gave us. So we've been looking at those for the last couple of years, and now we're in chapters 23 to 25. Now, just so you know, here's the last week of Jesus' life. Okay, this is what we call the Passion Week. And chapter 23 was all about the temple controversies. This is probably happening on Tuesday morning of the last week of Jesus' life. There's been the triumphal entry on Sunday. Then on Monday, he does a few things. He cleanses out the temple. He's not making friends there very quickly. He cleanses it out and says, you've made this into a den of robbers, and this is supposed to be a house of prayer. This isn't what God intended. And he cleanses it out. Now, the next day, he comes back, and he's entering into the temple. He's teaching, and there's tremendous controversy when he's in the temple. People, he fires them up. I mean, he is saying some of the most difficult things he ever said in his entire ministry are recorded here in the temple controversies. Now, today we're going to transfer into that afternoon and evening, which is what we call the Olivet Discourse. So all that means is he's on the Mount of Olives, and they come to him and he begins to teach them. Now, in chapter 23, Matthew 1 through 12, it's this. He says to the leaders of his day, to the religious leaders, when you exalt yourself, when you lift yourself up, you elevate, separate, and you isolate yourselves from one another, and you rob God of his majesty. And that's what he's so harsh on them with them. When they were elevating themselves, making them more important than everyone else, and more important than all the people around them, and they wanted to be seen for all of their religiousness. And Jesus was very tough on them. And then in verses 13 through 39, he gives what we call the seven woes and one wow, right? When he says, when you exalt yourselves, he says, you are in great danger. Woe to you, warning to you. And he gives this on these religious leaders. And I just have to say, it's really easy to kind of get down on them and think we're so slick, but I think we have to look at ourselves as religious people sometimes and how often we slip into that. And he says the woes are very strong. And the wow is this. If you had allowed me to gather you as like a hen gathers her chicks, I would have done it. That's my heart for you. But you didn't let me do it. And there is this great judgment. Now, as we start into today, I want to just talk a little bit philosophically. So let's draw a line up here on the screen. Basically, Christianity is very linear or directional or seasonal in its understanding of history. That it has a beginning, it has a middle, and that there's going to be an end. It's very directional, it's very linear in nature. Now, there are other ways to see the world. You could look at the world as being cyclical. On the most part, Buddhism, Hinduism, other religions, it's very much about a cycle of reincarnation, of coming around, sometimes a spiral, but still cyclical. You're supposed to get better, or maybe you get worse and you come back. Like if you lived a really good life as a human being, you might become a Brahmana. Or if you live not very well, you might become an ant. in the next life. It's very cyclical in the way it goes. And it just goes on and on and on, not very directional. Or sometimes you look at history this way. The history is simply chaos. It's just kind of nutty. It's just kind of like one thing leads to another and it moves all over the place and who knows if it has any direction or meaning whatsoever, but it's very chaotic. Here we see biblically that history is linear. It's directional. It is seasonal in its development. So now, inside of that, are there cycles? Yeah, of course. We see that certain things kind of come around and they go around and come around and keep going. There's some cycles to it. Do we have some, what at least on our side of life looks chaotic? Right, of course. And sometimes you think, man, what in the world is going on? But in general, we find it to be very directional and very linear. John Warwick Montgomery, he's a Christian professor and apologist, he said this, "The importance of the biblical concept, a conception, cannot be overstressed. Here, for the first time, Western man has presented with a purposive or purposeful goal-directed interpretation of history. The classical doctrine of recurrence or cyclical had been able to give substantiality or substance to history, but it had not given it any aim or direction." Right? Because this is the deal. Direction, as always, comes from God. God gives history direction. It gives it a linearness, a developmentalness, a seasonalness. God is doing things throughout history into what we call redemptive history to draw man back to himself. So in Genesis chapter 3, mankind rebelled. We call it the Great Fall. And this relationship with God was stressed and fractured and broken, and not just with God, but with each other. But that God, in his redemptiveness, is doing something to draw man back to himself. And man keeps saying, no, thank you. I don't know about you, but for that, it was a bunch of my life. But there are times in life where life gets so hard that you say, okay, wait a second. This isn't going well. Directing my own life, whether it be cyclical or chaotically, isn't working. God, what do you have to say? How do I enter into that redemptive relationship with you? And he takes us in that direction, right? And that's what Christ was all about, to pay the penalty for all of our sin and our rebellion and to draw us back into a relationship with him, right? Okay, so if history is linear, it's directional and it's seasonal, let's see what happens here in Matthew, okay? So let's go to Matthew chapter 24. We're going to go verses 1 through 14. And it says here that Jesus left the temple, remember? So he's just been in the temple, he's been teaching, he's been talking about things, and they are not happy with him, okay? So he left the temple, and he was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. So I find it interesting. I don't know what they're trying to do exactly. It feels like they're trying to kind of lighten up the situation. It'd been very heavy in the temple, right? So they're leaving, and as the disciples came to him and they said, man, look at the temple. Isn't it beautiful? Look at these other buildings. Look at the incredible wall. This is a great place, you know? And because it's just been really hard, and it seems like they're trying to lighten up the situation. And then Jesus is having none of it. Look at verse 2. And Jesus answered them, and he said, you see all these? Do you not? Do you not see all this? And then he says, I say to you, there will not be left here one stone on another that will not be thrown down. And they're like, oh, Jesus, I wish I'd never said anything. You know? Like, oh, man, we were supposed to be trying to make this better, and you just made it ultimately worse. They could not imagine that this thing called the temple would be torn down and destroyed, not one rock left on another. The temple was one of the most incredible buildings, and the walls around it. Little did they know that probably 40 years later that the Romans would come into Jerusalem and destroy the entire city and take the temple and destroy it in every way. And so he says, all of this is going to be torn down. And I'm imagining these guys saying, oh, man, what are we doing now? This thing's not going well. Jesus has been telling us for a while that he was going to be arrested and murdered. And then he rises from the dead. And they were having a hard time getting their arms around that. And so here he is, that things in the temple had gone poorly. And they're like, hey, let's talk about the temple. It's cool. He's like, yeah, it's all going to get torn down. Oh. So let's go to verse 3. And he sat on the Mount of Olives. So this is just to the east of Jerusalem. It's more of a hill. When you think about the Rocky Mountains, you think this is more of a hill. But it's the Mount of Olives, just east of there. And Jesus sat down on that hill, and he was looking out over Jerusalem. He's brokenhearted, really, frankly. And in that place, it says that the disciples came to him privately, saying, now just so you know, in Mark 13, we know it wasn't all the disciples. Mark 13 tells us that it was Peter, James, John, and Andrew. So kind of the inner three, Peter, James, and John, and Andrew, Peter's brother, they came to him and they said, hey, we've been hearing all this. It didn't feel like good news to us, but we're going to engage this finally. Because oftentimes they seem to have not engaged. You know how that is? Sometimes when you're having a little bit of a difficult time and someone, maybe your spouse or maybe a child or maybe someone, and they say something that's really hard and you're like, okay, I think I'm just not going to engage. Hey, thanks for telling me. See ya. You know, we just kind of don't engage. I know you don't do that, but I think sometimes I do that. And here, they finally engaged. Peter, James, John, and Andrew, they say this. Two things. Tell us when these things will be. All right, if this is happening, tell us when. When's this going to go down? And secondly, and what will be the sign of your coming of the end of the age? When and what? So, this is getting down to the nitty-gritty. This is the last week. And so they ask him what's going on here. When and what's going to happen? Now, you guys, when we began to put together eschatology, so eschatology is the study of end times. So they're asking, what's going to happen here? And when's it going to happen? How will we know? Now, we take the Bible and we try to put together all the information and we try to systematize it or organize it or make it look like something, right? So here's just a comparison of Christian millennial teachings. So we talk about the millennium. I'll talk about that in a second. But here are four different views. There's the post-tribulation, pre-millennial view. That means we think he's going to come back post-tribulation, at the end of a tribulation. I'll talk about it in a minute. But before the millennium, the 1,000 years, we'll talk about it. Then there's the pre-tribulational, dispensational, premillennialism. There's also a post-millennialism. There's an amillennialism. You go, oh my gosh, you're giving me a headache, you know? So I'm going to try to make sense of this without getting too deep. Now, there are other people who want to chart all of this, right? Look at this chart. Here's a chart that someone came up with of the prophecies. Now, honestly, this chart is a pretty good one. But for us to go through this chart this morning, we'd be here until next week. You know, we'd have to call out for meals. You know, Uber or DoorDash would have to come for all of us. Because this is just like, oh my golly, how do you do all this stuff? And I do want to say this. There are lots and lots of pieces to the prophecy of end times that come from all over the Bible. Not only here in Matthew, and not only in Thessalonians in the New Testament, obviously, the book of Revelation. If you go into the Old Testament, you get Daniel and Ezekiel and Zechariah and Isaiah and Malachi and all sorts of places. And so when you try to put all of it together, lots and lots of Christian theologians, scholars, put it together differently. And they think, no, it goes here, or no, it goes there. And so you try to understand it as best you can. But at the end of it, I am a pan-millennialist. Meaning that it'll all pan out in the end. You know, so now, do we want to try to understand it? Yes, of course, we want to try to understand it. But here's just a little bit of a context or a framework, okay? So here, we in this line, this linear, seasonal, directional line, you have the church age. That's us. That's us today. That this church age is a growing contractions of birth pangs. It is this growing and directional issues that are going on that reveal that the world is in desperate need of redemption and restoration. Do you feel that? I think we all feel that. And probably the last few years have kind of turned that flame up a little bit. So we live in this thing called the church age. In Revelation 20, it seems to talk about this thing called a millennium. It doesn't just mention it once in that chapter, but it mentions it a bunch of times. Now, this is the only chapter that really deeply talks about a thousand-year reign of Christ. So some people say, how are you going to base an entire theology on one chapter? But the chapter seems to be pretty clear, and as I look at this, I think this really happens. There's going to be a time where Jesus returns and he reigns on the earth for 1,000 years. And some would speculate that we get to reign with him. And you think, oh, that's a great idea. I'd like to take the Rocky Mountains, you know, and I'll sign up for that. Or maybe you want to do St. Louis, or maybe you want to do somewhere around the world. I don't know, but some of you want to go to Paris. You're like, hey, I'd like to rule over Paris. It's probably not going to be where we're Mr. Slick if we get to reign with him. It'll be in to the obedience of Christ. But there seems to be a millennial, thousand-year reign of Christ. Now, for a lot of people, and I think I agree, there seems to be, put between these, or kind of at the end of the church age, 7 years of tribulation, where there's both peace in the first half of those 7 years, and then great wrath in the next 3.5 years. It's called the tribulation time. Now, one of the questions is, well, when does Jesus come back? What is the second coming of Christ, the time when he returns to the earth? And there's all sorts of speculation about that. Some believe it'll come at the beginning of the tribulation. Others believe he'll come at the end of the tribulation. Others think it'll be midway through the tribulation. And so scholars are all over the map on that. Some think it's going to happen at the end of the millennium. And if you're really that on this next slide, that's for what we call amillennialists, who don't really believe in that believe that the thousand-year reign of Christ is figurative, not literal, and that he'll come at that, and that things are going to get better during those 1,000 years, and that we're probably in the midst of that, maybe entering the end of it. And they said things are going to get better and better and better, and Jesus will come at the end of that. I don't know. It seems to me that history doesn't suggest that. I don't think things are getting better. And so I don't think amillennial view is really a very good option. So we go back to this other view of millennial with the church age, with the tribulation, and with the second comings. And at the end of the age is at the end of the tribulation, before the thousand-year reign of Christ. That's what he's talking about, the end of the age, because it enters into a whole new deal when Jesus returns and reigns on the earth. Okay? Now, so the chapters we're going to talk about today end up being this church age, maybe, and who knows how many more years of the church age, but it's in this time today and maybe into the tribulation. Okay, so that's what chapter 24, this early part, is going to talk about. Okay, now, it could be during the tribulation. It could be before the tribulation. I suspect that it's during the church age, before the tribulation, is what he's talking about. So let's jump into verse 4 of Matthew, okay? So Jesus answered them. Now, just so you know, he doesn't answer when. He answers what. He doesn't give a lot of clarity. This actually is about a 30,000-foot level response. He doesn't dive down into all the details like on that chart I showed you, okay? It's going to be kind of a 30,000-foot look. And so Jesus answered them. And he says these. These are really important. He says, see that no one leads you astray. Let's isolate that. Right? See that no one leads you astray. So it's going to be one of the marks of these closing days that there are going to be all sorts of opportunities and people wanting to lead people astray. Okay? Now, look at verse 5. He says, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and they will lead many astray. There are people. They're going to say, I am the Christ. It's going to happen increasingly intensely as the time comes. But there are all sorts of people who have really placed themselves as God. And we could name lots of them, whether it be Jim Jones or Waco, David Koresh, others who have just said amazing things and drawn people into really twisted places of living. And they kind of set themselves up as God, or at least a demigod. Well, he says, be aware. People are going to lead people astray. Don't follow them, he says. Look at verse 6. He says, and you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See to it that you're not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise up against nation and kingdom against kingdom. You know, today there are lots of wars going on in the world. There are lots of rumors of war. We see that. We feel that. We experience that. That's nothing particularly new. That's been true for a long time. And for a lot of people during World War II, they thought, wow, this has got to be it. Most of the world is at war. There's a whole arena in Europe. There's one in the Pacific. I mean, it was a crazy time, right? And people are saying, this has got to be the end. Or other times. But there have been wars and rumors of wars for a long time. But these are birth pangs leading up. But he says, don't get alarmed. Don't get freaked out. This is not the end yet, because nations will rise up against nations. And kingdoms will rise up against kingdoms. It's part of the deal. It's part of a broken world. And we have to face that and embrace that and understand that. All right. Then look at the last part of verse 7. And there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. If you go and study the frequency of earthquakes, it's an up and down. Sometimes there's a lot. Sometimes there are fewer. There are earthquakes still today. Just recently, I know Turkey had an incredibly horrible earthquake. Morocco just had an incredibly horrible earthquake. They happen. There, we have our own fault in southern Missouri. It could happen here. Remember the one that happened? It was in the 1700s. There's an earthquake here, and it rang bells in the churches in Philadelphia. That's how strong it was. So they happen. These are all birth pains. Because look at here in verse 8. It says, all these are but the beginning of birth pains. These are just the beginning. It's part of the way the world is today. But they will increase. But don't get too freaked out about it. Okay? Now, let's go on to verse 9. He dives a little deeper. He says, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Now, this is not part that we really love, right? I'm like, that's not really my idea. I'd like to erase this part. I don't really want this part. But he says, if you're going to be identified with me, there's going to be tribulation for you, and you'll be hated by all nations for his name's sake. That seems to, at least in America, to have increased in recent years. That as Christians, you have now been called judgmental, bigots, all sorts of things. But you will face it for the name of Christ. Now, you guys, there was an article I read this week, and it was called The Gospel is Offensive, and It is Intended to Be. You thought, oh, man, I don't love the name of that article. But I read it, and I thought there was some fairness to it. First thing it said was this. You cannot remove the offensiveness without losing everything. There is an offensiveness to the gospel because the gospel says you're broken. You're sinful. And the thing is, I guess I find that in a weird way comforting, because it is actually our experience, isn't it? We experience our own brokenness of those around us and that person in us. And the gospel says, you're broken, Kevin. I don't really love that, but actually it matches my reality. It probably matches your reality, but I can know that it doesn't fit well. Yesterday during Celebrate Wildwood, there was a group of guys that came up to the table. Well, they didn't really come up to the table. They were standing by the table that we were at. And there was one guy says, hey, what's this booth about? And I said, oh, it's a church. And he goes, oh. And he pulled away. And this guy, nice beard, great tats. And I grabbed him by the arm, and he's like solid as a rock. I mean, it was just like, okay, you've been in the gym. And I said, well, you know what? You probably need a church. He said, no. And then I said, well, your friend says you do, which was not true. His friend had not said that. And I thought it would be a little bit funny. And he's like, no, thank you. And he pulled away and walked away. And they all were like stone cold. Like, and I'm like, okay, I don't think I did a great job there. You know, but he was like, no, thank you. You ever had someone just tell you? Now, I've had that where people just say, get out of my face. You are such a jerk. You know, I'm like, whoa. You know, it's hard. But people, you guys, the gospel is offensive to people. It is. It's great news for some. It's for others it feels offensive. And to make it non-offensive means you have to lose the gospel. Right? Second point this article made. The point of the story is not congratulations, but confrontation. Jesus confronts us in our lives and with our sin, with the brokenness that we live out in the brokenness of our world. He confronts us with that. Third thing this article said is the story is not ultimately about us anyway. This is about Him. This is about Christ. So don't be so afraid. Don't make it about you, Kevin. Make it about Christ. And the last one I think is really good, and this is one we probably could learn. The gospel is offensive, but you don't have to be. You don't have to be offensive. You can be honest, you can be real, you can be friendly, you can be connecting, you can call it like it is, but you don't have to become a knucklehead about it, right? And I really think that in our culture in recent years, that's what's happened, is that somehow the anger of our culture has entered into our evangelism, and it's become an angry evangelism. Rather than an honest evangelism, but engage people for who they are. Love them. Understand them. Wrestle with it. You don't have to be offensive. And that's where I think we've lost ground in recent years in Christianity. Okay, verse 9. Let's go to verse 10. Not only will we be hated, but it says, and many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. Many will fall away. You guys, we're speaking here of believers. He's speaking primarily here to Israel. But I think this is applicable for us, that many will fall away, will betray each other, and will hate one another. And will lose the very opportunity to explain the gospel by the way we live and the way we love is by hating each other. Wow. That's pretty powerful. Now, here's another one. We'll go to verse 11. For many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. He kind of already commented on that. But there are going to be false prophets for sure, a major part of what goes on. And we'll have to be very careful with that. Look at verse 12. And because lawlessness will be increased, you know, I think the spirit of our day is a chaos and a violent conflict. That is the spirit of our day. And lawlessness will be increased. And it says, and love of many will grow cold. There is this uniqueness that when lawlessness or unrestrained evil happens, people get cold and angry and reserved, and they push back, and our love will grow cold. Does that not describe our day? That the love of people has grown cold. It almost feels radically weird to love people actively in our culture. It almost feels offensive to love. People are like, get away from me. Push back. Rather than engaging with love. Verse 13. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. The one who endures through this will be saved. And that may be my favorite. Look at this in verse 14. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations. You guys, the world needs to hear. The world needs to hear the incredible news of Christ. He's the only hope that we have. He's the only one. As I was talking with the pastor yesterday of Union Baptist Church of Chesterfield, his name was Raymond, and Raymond said, you know, I've been a part of all sorts of groups here in the city, get together for meetings and committees. And he says, at the end of the day, no one does anything. And he said, I'm done. I'm done with committees. I'm committed to loving people because Jesus is the only answer in a human heart. And I'm done with doing it by committee. We're just going to do it as believers. I tell you what, was that refreshing or what? It's like, wow, yes. Now I want to get together. Now let's talk. Because it was so encouraging. To take the gospel to the whole world. There are still people groups in the world who have never heard the name of Jesus. Ever. There are languages that still need the gospel. And they would go, oh my gosh, You mean God speaks my language? Yes. He speaks all those dialects. He created those dialects that the whole world needs to know. You guys, we're getting there, but we're not quite done. Because look at this in the end of 14. It says, and when that happens, and then the end will come. Man, will that be a great day or what? And that we get to be a part of that, right? We get to be a part, not only here in St. Louis, but we're connected to some people around the world who are taking the gospel to people who have never heard. And that is such an incredible thing. So let's go back to my chart here, okay? I think these chapters are talking about this thing called the church age, where there's this growing contractions and birth pangs going on, the coming up to the end. And he gave us some ideas about where to go with it. So really the question is, so what do we do with it now? What do we do with this passage? I've got six thoughts here, okay? The first one is this. Don't get freaked out over the birth pangs, right? Don't get freaked out. Sometimes you just kind of lose. You go, oh my gosh, the world's coming unglued. Well, yeah, that's true, but it is there. God is taking it in a direction. You don't need to get freaked out about it. He's still in charge. Maybe probably one of the greatest comments ever, right? God is still in charge. It doesn't feel like it. I know it doesn't feel like it. You know, it doesn't look like it. I know it doesn't look like it. But he is. He's still in charge, not only of the world, but he's in charge of your life. He's in charge of my life. He's able to be trusted. So don't freak out at the birth pangs, right? They're going to happen. They've been happening all along. And they're going to continue to happen. Second thought. We need to be astute when evaluating whether someone's teaching is sound doctrine or not. We need to individually be students of God's word. Because people have to be evaluated. Because there are going to be people who want to lead you astray. There are going to be false prophets. There are going to be people who lie. There are going to be people who do it for their own reasons and for their own good. And you have to be ready for it. Right? You have to be astute. You have to be a student of God's word. That's why we do Bible studies. That's why we get together. That's what we do this for, is to be ready. Right? To be knowledgeable people. Third, human conflict and natural disasters are evidence of a world that is aching for resolution and redemption. You guys, you feel the groaning? The scriptures even talk that nature is groaning for solution and for resolution. Mankind is groaning the same way. But all of the human conflict in the world today is all about that. And that the natural disasters are all about that, looking for resolution. Fourth, we will be associated with Christ and the gospel. And we will risk being persecuted for it. That's what he teaches. You guys, they're going to hate you too. They'll hate you because of me. Don't have them hate you because of you. You know, sometimes they hate us because we're obnoxious. Let's let the gospel be obnoxious. Let's let the gospel be offensive. Let's not do it personally. But when we're associated with him and the gospel, there are going to be persecutions. Tribulations is the word Jesus used. There will be. It'll come. And sometimes you just have to be willing to weather the storm because it's going to happen. That's hard. Next. Unrestrained evil or lawlessness produces relational callousness. Unrestrained evil, lawlessness, makes people push away from each other, right? It makes us afraid of each other. It makes us scared about life. And he says, don't let it do that. Be courageous. Keep moving forward. Engage people. Love people. It's risky. You're right. It is. But keep moving forward. That guy who came up with the tats and this big solid arm, you know, I wish I could see him again and say, hey, you may be pushing away from it, but what's going on in your life? Why? The gospel makes sense. It reaches the deepest place of human need. What in his life is he saying, no, I don't want it? Unrestrained evil and lawlessness produces relational callousness and coldness. Let's be a warm people. I think Jesus is saying, let's be a warm and embracing people. Doesn't mean we agree with everything, but I'm going to love you because of your humanity, made in the image of God. You're made in the image of God, every one of you. Every person out there, made in the image of God. Wow. And here's my last thought. Every people group in the world are deep in the heart of God. Every people group in the world, God has this incredible heart for. Every one of them. Whether they're overseas or right next door. Whether it's an African American community right up here on a hill about 3 miles from here. Or maybe in your neighborhood, in my neighborhood, an increasing level of Indian families. So the largest growing population here in West County are Indians. Most of them Hindu. Not all, but most of them Hindu. There are 2 Hindu temples being built within a few miles of this church. One just south of here, less than 0.5 mile. One just a couple of miles up the road. And they don't know the love of Christ, the answer that he is. They've come here. God has brought the world to us, and we get to do it right here. And we can go to the world, right? Because when he says, when all of this is done, then the end will come. When everyone's heard, had an opportunity. I think, wow, that's incredible. So Jesus didn't tell us a whole lot about the exact when, but he told us a lot about the what. And these are things that we can live by. We can trust this week. And so God is doing things directionally, right? Linearly. He's doing things seasonally. He's developing this. And whether this is the end days, I don't know for sure, right? People have been saying this is the end days for a long time. People have been looking for the coming of Christ for 2,000 years. But the real reality is he says, just be ready. It's going to come when you're not quite sure, but be ready. But know what's going to be happening. This week, you're going to face every one of these, okay? So don't be surprised. Be strong in your faith. Walk with him. Allow him to do what he wants to do in your life, right? All right. You guys, let's pray. Father, thank you that you gave us an understanding, maybe not of all the details in every way, shape, or form, but you've given us, Jesus gave us so much right here in chapter 24 that's so real to our lives today. Father, I pray that we would take it seriously, that we would understand, that we'd be able to engage it. And Father, help us not to shrink away in fear, but help us to move forward with courage, with confidence in you, because you're still in charge. Father, thank you that we can trust you and that we can love you because you loved us first. You loved us so deeply. Everything about us, you love. And that you can rebuild lives that are broken. And we all need that, every one of us. And Father, even for the people in our community here, it's all broken. Pray that your redemptive and healing hand would touch this community. And Father, help use us as part of that process to make a difference right here in St. Louis. So build our lives, Father. We give it to you.